Welcome to Town Square. I'm Neil Milner, sitting in for Beth Ann Kozlovich. Today's guest is Jim Dooley, whom the writer Paul Thoreau calls Hawaii's bravest investigative reporter. Why bravery? Because for many years on TV and in newspapers, Jim broke virtually all of the big stories about corruption in Hawaii. His new book, Sunny Skies, Shady Characters, tells many of these stories, how he dug them out, and what it's like to work as an investigative reporter where many powerful people, from politicians to hitmen to his editors, all too often didn't like what he was doing. We'll talk about corruption in Hawaii then and now, as well as the challenges that an investigative reporter faces flushing corruption out. Remember, you can call us. I encourage it. Phone is 941-3689. On the neighbor islands, it's 877-941-3689. Jim, welcome to Town Square.
Thanks, Neil. It's a pleasure to be here.
Good. So one of the things that interested me when I was actually going back and reading the book again is starting the book with Don Ho. This is a book about corruption, and Don Ho is not a political official. He's not a hitman. He's not a lot of things that you associated. Why did you start there?
Well, it was kind of the beginning of the end for me at the Advertiser. You know, when Don was, he was really kind of a Frank Sinatra sort of figure. You know, he's nothing corrupt or evil about him. But he had lots of alarming friends, and when he passed away, and then Chuck Marsland, the former city prosecutor, passed away within a very short period of time, the difference in how the then management of the Advertiser viewed those two deaths and the funerals and burials and all that really struck me. I was trying to find something that was a little bit more current than many of the contents in the book.
Well, it seems to me that there's a lot of things in the Don Ho story that give hints to what corruption was like in other places. You mentioned one being these unsavory characters that are hanging around him. I mean, it's as if he's the center of a lot of kind of contacts that people make, people who are pretty unsavory later on. So but he's never really charged with any – he's never involved in any kind of organized crime activity. There are some rumors that swirl around about him and women.
Right. That's true. There were no charges or convictions of any sort.
This is also one of the examples of when you had to show a little bit of bravery when you went down to – when you wanted to see – Don Ho.
Well, it wasn't exactly my idea, and I don't know if it was bravery or we were just foolhardy, you know. But it was, you know, it's the kind of thing where, you know, you have to talk to him. You gotta get his side of the story. So that was another reporter was a lead. Walter Wright was a lead reporter on it, and he wanted someone to go with him, and I reluctantly went along.
But what were you asking him about?
We were asking him about a rape accusation that had been made against him by a couple of tourist women.
And did he talk to you directly about it?
Yes. I mean, a denial and anger and bluster and like that. But yeah, he eventually did talk to us.
So let me, before we go too much farther, let's talk a little bit about what it's like being an investigative reporter so that people can get some sense of it. When you identify yourself as an investigative reporter, how do you distinguish that from being a regular reporter? What was the difference?
The difference is really time, you know, that you're allowed to work on a story and to research and to write. That's really the only difference. The work is basically the same. There's no, you don't do anything really any differently than any other reporter does. It is simply have a little bit more time to research a story and to write it. And you know, the subjects tend to be a little bit more serious, I expect you would say, but like I said, it's just, you know, I never told people, you know, look, when I called up for an interview, this is Jim Dooley, I'm an investigative reporter. I just said I'm a reporter for the Advertiser or for KITV or Hawaii Reporter or wherever I was working.
After a while, they probably knew.
Yeah, they did.
They were doing special kind of stuff. How did you get into it?
Well, I came out here from San Francisco. After college, I applied for various jobs. My father was a newsman. My sister was a journalist, and so I applied for jobs in the San Francisco area. And only United Press International responded with an offer, and they said they had an opening in Hawaii if I wanted to pay my own way out here. And I said, "Well, it's better than nothing." And I had never been to Hawaii before, so that's how I got here. That was in the height of the Watergate era. The hearings had been on television. I was watching all that, and kind of keeping track of, Woodward and Bernstein and what they had been doing. So I think every reporter who came of age at that time wanted to be an investigative reporter and wanted to be, Woodward or Bernstein.
But you had started, you really hadn't planned on being a reporter, at least when you were in college, right?
I didn't really have any plans at all when I was in college. I was just sort of sliding along.
You were an English major.
That's right. And I always figured, because of my background, my father, my sister, I would become a reporter.
Don't forget the number to call is 941-3689 and 877-941-3689 on the Neighbor Islands. You use, before we get into some of the other more specific stories, you use the terms syndicate and organized crime off and on, sometimes interchangeably. And it seems to me those terms connote a kind of level of organization that doesn't seem to be that much apparent in a number of these situations. It's not, if you say to some people, organized crime, they'll think of the mafia, which is or the Cosa Nostra, which is fairly well organized. A lot of these situations that you ran into here, I'm talking about the kind of heavy duty crime stuff as opposed to some of the political things that we'll talk about. Mm-hmm. They didn't seem very well organized at all.
Not too terribly well organized, although I think that there was a serious attempt at organization in the late 60s, early 70s, and to a certain extent that succeeded. It was kind of centralized, and they had lieutenants, and guys were calling the shots and controlling certain types of crime, but that deteriorated over time. A lot, it's a small town, in a small state, and not really any place to hide. And I think that particularly the federal investigators had some success at breaking up the organizations.
So early on, it was, when you're talking about the 60s, it's mainly gambling.
Gambling. It's always been gambling at the heart of everything, I think.
At the heart of all of that sort of thing. Although that, over time, I think, begins to change. And we'll come back to that later when we talk about how things have changed overall here. When you think about the most significant political corruption story you broke, which one would you choose?
I would have to say it was Kukui Plaza because of the results of that. I don't know.
You may have to go back and tell some of you.
Anybody remembers Kukui Plaza?
You and I remember it, yeah. And I'm pretty sure I know why you're picking it, but tell the story.
Well, I just started out, as a reporter at the Advertiser, and I was assigned over to the Capital Bureau for the Advertiser on a temporary basis because a couple of people had left. And so the Capital Bureau covered both the state capital and state government and city hall and city government. And so I was sitting in the Capitol one day and I was covering City Hall, and Frank Fossey was the mayor at the time, and Mr. Fossey was notably unfriendly towards the news media, and sometimes openly hostile, other times just sort of gruff, and didn't have a lot of time for reporters. But I got a call from somebody who had information about connections or relations between Mr. Fossey's political organization and a big developer who is developing a big city project called Kukui Plaza. The allegations were that the Fossey organization was squeezing the development company for a lot of money. Oceanside Properties was the name of the company, which in fact was headquartered right nearby here. So I started checking on that, and it turned out to be in fact true. And as a result of that, those stories, the city council, which knew nothing about what was going on, they actually had their own investigation. I don't think that's ever happened since, where they actually hired lawyers and issued subpoenas and held hearings, and then the federal government was conducting its own investigation, as was the state, and the president of Oceanside Properties was indicted on federal fraud charges, and Mr. Fossey and his chief fundraiser, Harry Chung, were indicted by a state grand jury on fraud charges.
This whole thing, when I read it now in the nice way that you present it, it is so not subtle. When you say squeezed, that squeezing is a form of pay to play, but this was so obvious. Tell a little bit more about who got good deals from this in terms of building Kukui Plaza.
Well, Mr. Chung's company, he ran a furniture company, 20th Century Furniture. They got the contract to supply all the carpets and drapes and many of the coin operated laundry services, and they got all that. His company, the mayor's office would call, you know, Oceanside and say, you know, we need a camera, you know, and so the Oceanside Properties would go out and buy a camera, you know, he'd supply it to the campaign or to the mayor's office itself, and we need office supplies, and they had so many office supplies they had to store them at Oceanside, it went on and on and on. It was constant demand for goods and services and money.
We're talking with Jim Dooley, the investigative reporter who has written a book recently about the stories that he covered called Sunny Skies and Shady Characters. One of my favorite quotes from that book, it's not your quote, you quote somebody else's, that in the Kukui Plaza situation when the consul does the investigation, and it's pretty clear that some outrageous things went on, including people getting the inside track on apartments, which were supposed to be for low and moderate income. And so one of the Fossey officials testifying says, sometimes in our system, the people who have the right kind of friends, they get what you might call equity. I can't imagine anybody saying that nowadays in a public, even though it may still be right.
As I recall, he said that under oath before the city council. What had happened was that part of the project, the requirements of the city was a certain number of units in the Kukui Plaza development had to be set aside for people who met low and moderate income requirements. And in fact, that the first people who were supposed to get first shot at those apartments had been evicted and moved out of the development area. Well, then the city never really kept track of what happened to all those people. So they had an awful time finding them. And then they said, okay, but you know, low moderate income, and there's so many people that qualify for this, we're going to have a drawing. And then it turned out that in fact people with equity, with inside connections at City Hall, got the inside track on some of those units, you know, and the man that made that testimony, Ralph Aoki, I mean, they had him dead to rights. I mean, his secretary had gotten one of the units.
There you go. Well, and that comes up later on in the story that you don't cover very much, which is Salt Lake, where a number of people, the secretaries of a number of powerful people, in fact, get those kinds of things. Kukui Plaza was really supposed to be one of the models for how slum clearance, as it used to be called then, was supposed to work in mm-hmm. urban Honolulu, in downtown mm-hmm. Honolulu. The feds were very much interested in this. The idea was you didn't salvage buildings, you knocked them down, and you built high rises. And so this was supposed to be, in a sense, a model of equity. And the only equity that it was a model of is the kind that that Aoki talks about, right, in that sort of situation. Mm-hmm. It's an example, a not very subtle example of pay to play, mm-hmm. and can you talk about some other examples in the book where you've seen pay to play operate?
Well, you know, the pay-to-play system is really it tends to be a rather subtle. I mean, it's not, you know, the quid pro quo where, you know, you give something in order to get something. You know, frequently, you know, you get both the quid and the quo, but at the middle part of it, you know, the pro, you know, the agreement, it's any sort of a corrupt agreement. You never, you know,
that's why it's so seldom prosecuted.
Right.
Because if it were a quid pro quo, then would violate the law.
Yeah. But so, you know, I mean, it was easy enough to find, you know, situations like that where you just go over to, you know, to find donations from a particular company or officials of a company and to a particular official, and then find the contracts that officials had a hand in awarding to that company. So you got the two ends of it, but finding the agreement that if you give me money, then I'll give you a job. You know, that was always the hard part.
But it seems as if it becomes institutionalized in one way or another, this kind of gray area quid pro quo.
Uh-huh.
You talk in there about one example that's fairly obvious, but was actually one of, I think, the first times when they look more closely at it, which it turns out that the wait staff at the Maple Garden restaurant were unusually willing to donate a fair amount of money per person into the political coffers.
Yeah. That was I had been looking at the records at the Campaign Spending Commission and noticed that for a variety of different candidates or officials, their campaigns had gotten money from a variety of different employees who worked at the Maple Garden restaurant. But, you know, I mean, fairly low level, you know, busboys, you know, and waiters and cooks, you know, were giving fairly substantial amounts of money to people. So at that time, you know, I basically sort of stumbled over that. There was no electronic, you know, records, and you couldn't, you know. So I just sort of went candidate or official by official and looked and looked for Maple Garden, you know, employees. And so that's how I basically fell upon that. It turned out that then an engineering company that got a lot of work from government, R.M. Towel, that they owned or had owned at Maple Garden restaurant. So that was the connection.
So when you stumble upon this, let's talk about this stumbling for a second. How do you find information? I mean, this, you know, in this day and age, people assume that you can, and they're right, how much you can get on the internet and how much of it is stored away. And, and if you watch the way Ian Lynn puts together really good stories in his blog on the basis of pretty much archival information.
Mm-hmm.
You couldn't do that. At least the archives weren't available that way. So what'd you do? I mean, what was your, I'm going to use a big word here, methodology?
Well, there were two different kinds of stories. One usually started with a tip or an insider who had information. Those usually tended to be the best, you know, because you know they, you know, you didn't have to hunt and scratch and pull away layers. You know, these were people on the inside. But there's others, you know, where you get interested in a subject and you say, how does this work, you know, and how did this particular airport job get done? And so, you know, you just start. My methodology was to always to attack it, first of all, to find whatever paperwork there was and gather, you know, as much stuff on the record that way, and then try to assimilate all that stuff and develop questions, and then go to the people involved and ask them, you know, how, you know, well, what about this? How come you did this? Or, you know, what this document says is, you know, and what do you have to say about that? That was kind of the way that I tried to do my work.
So they have a harder time weaseling out of it if they deny something. You say, well, I've got it written on paper,
right? And they were, and sometimes they were impressed that you'd actually taken the time, you did your homework, and you knew what you were talking about, or at least you thought you knew what you were talking about. So yeah, that was and to a certain extent, you know, some people, you know, they're kind of, yeah, I found this true to be even of organized crime figures. You know, they're kind of proud of, you know, of what they've done. It's a profession to them, and they've achieved success, and they kind of like the recognition.
They all seem to talk to you with a certain amount of aloha. These kind of hardcore. I'm not talking here about the smooth people, the Bishop of State ones, but people like Ron Ching and folks who were pretty sure were hitmen or had done murdering or had almost been murdered in the past.
Mm-hmm.
They always seem to be willing to talk to you.
Well, so and to a certain extent, that's Hawaii. You know, people are friendly, and they treat you with aloha. You know, but they also. I think there was once again there was a kind of a function of, well, you know, this guy seems to it's inevitable that this guy's going to do a story, so I may as well, you know, get my side, you know, to him, and you know, but, you know, I never really got any really terrible, you know, death threats, you know, that or, you know, I got threats, but not the kind that I really took seriously.
The one of the sources that I've heard you talk about that you say is really invaluable is the Bureau of Conveyances. Most mm-hmm. of us have no idea what the Bureau of Conveyances is. What is it? How does it work?
It's the official place where you know, if you buy a house, you know, that's where your deed gets registered, and where you can look up, you know, who owns a piece of property. If you borrow money to buy a house, or borrow money, you know, to mortgage any sort of a mortgage, that's where it's located, at the Bureau of Conveyances. If there's a tax lien filed against you by the IRS or by the state tax department, that gets filed at the Bureau of Conveyances. If you change your name, you know, legally, that gets filed at the Bureau of Conveyances. There's all kinds of things that are on record at the Bureau of Conveyances.
Are they online now?
They are online to a certain extent. But for instance, when Larry Ellison bought Lanai, I looked up his company to see, you know, if they had any filings at the Bureau of Conveyances, and in fact there was a big tax lien pending against that company that I found online. But you have to go down to the Bureau and actually pull the paperwork to get details about how much or what kind of tax, you know, and that sort of stuff.
Ellison was having trouble scraping up the money, do you think?
Well, I don't know. I guess there was some sort of dispute about whether his company actually owed it or not. You know, I'm not sure.
941-3689 or 877-941-3689 if you're on the Neighbor Islands. You got any comments or questions about what you know about corruption in Hawaii in the past, or what you think you know or want to know more about in regard to corruption in Hawaii in the present or in the future, give us a call. You talked about the tax situation and how you get that sort of information through the Bureau of Conveyances. You have that interesting story in there about Regal Travels.
Mm-hmm.
And talk a bit about how that played out. That was a tax situation that you would
right.
come across.
I had launched myself on a investigation of the state tax department, and I think it was at a time of particularly acute distress in the state budget, and so the question was, well, how many outstanding taxes that are uncollected? How much are there? And so I was trying to find that out, you know, and I had actually gotten some help from the tax department, but it turned out that then they gave me all these records and then said, but you know, these records are they're no good. The date is bad, you know. But they did, you know, they did give me some. That was when I started out to try to do an actual computer assisted project, and I did get a lot of information, and then I found the references to a big tax lien that had been owed by a company called Regal Travel, and the tax had been written off, which I couldn't really understand, because Regal Travel was a going concern, and I couldn't quite understand why the state would have forgiven, you know, a tax lien like that. And then I further investigation showed that the state had believed that this company, Regal Travel, had actually gone out of business and was no longer in existence.
Really? I mean, there were a few Regal Travel offices around, right? If you drove down Kapahulu, for example, which many people do, mm-hmm. you would see a sign that said Regal Travel. They thought that they thought it was out of business.
Well, because Regal Travel had closed its doors and changed its its name, I think it was Regal Travel Limited, and then they reincorporated as Regal Travel Inc. And
so, pretty sophisticated move. What a fool me.
And the state claimed that they didn't know, you know. And so and then I did a bunch of stories about, you know, well, you know, are you going to collect the money now? And then eventually they did, yeah.
But the my second favorite quote, and I don't remember it quite the same way, is when the tax director essentially says to you, we'll give you a list of tax delinquents, and it's the best list we have, but it's totally unreliable.
That's right, yeah.
And but that raises another issue that seems to be in the shadows of some of these stories, some of them that have to do with real estate hooies, that the state simply doesn't have, in many of these situations, doesn't have the will or the capacity to monitor what's going on, so that they don't even know what's going on. I'm guessing that sometimes they don't even go to the Bureau of Conveyances to find out some of these
I'm
things.
I'm thinking they don't, yeah.
Yeah.
Well, that used to be, that was part of the tax story, was that the tax department's computers didn't talk to the computers of other departments. You know,
they still don't.
Yeah, and so it was impossible for them to check to find out, well, does this company, is it out of business or has it moved or what happened to this guy? You know, can we find him? They had no way of finding out. You know?
Well, they had one way. They could go over to the other place and actually check for
Yeah.
So when these sophisticated real estate operations began to form, the huis, mm-hmm. which was a very kind of Hawaiian sort of way to mm-hmm. do business. Mm-hmm. The way you tell the story is that there's this tug of war between what the huis are doing and what the state knows about, and the huis are always about 2-3 steps at least ahead of the state.
I don't think there was anything really nefarious about mm-hmm. that. It was just sort of how things developed, you know, that these sort of informal partnerships of friends and neighbors and family members got together and pooled what little money they had, you know, and to buy some real estate. And it became a little bit more suspicious, you know, as they got more sophisticated and large, and the people that were involved in them became more successful and influential and became part of government or, you know, part of business.
Yes.
and were able to perhaps influence, you know, the way, you know, the zoning of a parcel of land. So, but that was, you know, that was another one where I stumbled into it, you know, just by happenstance.
That's where the guy from Maui talks about that this is how we do business. Friends and neighbors get together
and
get things together. Gavin Dawes, in his book Land and Power in Hawaii, talks about some of these huis that developed, especially what he talks about Salt Lake as being an example of how land ownership, property ownership, began to get democratized in this state, that whatever other corruption there was involved with it or these kinds of semi-nefarious activities, one of the things that was happening is that Asian Americans here were for the first time getting relatively easy access to the ability to purchase real estate and make money out
mm-hmm.
of it.
Right.
And that's sort of the upside. But the huis were, there was a registration issue though, right? It wasn't so much about whether they were doing anything nefarious or not. The first issue was they were supposed to register these things.
Well, I think there's probably an issue about that to this day, you know, about whether or not they, you know, it depends on the type of hui it is. If it's, you know, family members, you know, who've gotten together and bought a piece of property, I don't think that has to be registered as a partnership or a limited partnership. But if it's, you know, unrelated people who've purchased property and then are taking action to increase the value of that land, then that in fact becomes a business entity that should be and registered with the state, and the members of the limited partners ought to be a matter of public record, but they weren't.
There were some pretty swift buying and selling property with some of these huis and some corporate officials on Maui, right, where you would turn over a piece of property very quickly and make a lot of money on it,
mm-hmm.
and there always was the suspicion that somebody knew in advance that this was going to happen.
Right. Well, I mean, that's kind of there's entire, you know, television networks devoted to the flipping in, you know, mm-hmm. of real estate. Now it's very common.
Well, there used to be, but it the period that you write about where the real estate deals are going on and the huis are going on and there's all this kind of friends and neighbors operation, and I understand that it's not necessarily illegal at all.
Mm-hmm.
this kind of small town networking of friends and neighbors seems to be less important now in regard to big real estate transactions.
Yeah.
You don't hear this kind of thing about Kaka'ako, let's say.
No, you don't.
Is that indicative of how things generally have changed in regard to how corruption works, that it's not so much a friends and neighbors kind of connection anymore?
Well, you know, I don't know. I'm not entirely sure that sort of stuff is not going on. I mean, I have real questions about some of these big new condos that are being built, you know, for multi-million dollar buyers, and it's the earlier steps of people who have been offered chances at these units and put some money down, and they're listed as the initial buyers, but then before the property ever gets built, then they go back on the market, and the initial group of people who've been offered a shot make a lot of money. And it's a question of, well, who are they, and, you know, why they get on the list to begin with?
Well, probably they're people who had money in the first place. Otherwise, they wouldn't have been able to afford even that initial thing and then be able to flip it.
Mm.
But that, again, you're right. That may be less about friends and neighbors than it is about the relationship between wealth and access,
mm-hmm.
in a more general way,
yeah.
which is very common in politics.
Mm-hmm.
Don't forget, give us a call when you want to talk about corruption or Hawaii politics or some of these other stories that we'll get into. And the number is 941-3689. And that's on Oahu and neighbor islands. It's 877-941-3689. We're talking with Jim Dooley, investigative reporter and the author of a fascinating book, Sunny Skies, Shady Characters. What happened to the Yakuza?
You know,
say a little bit of what you found when you were around.
Well, I got interested in the Yakuza. It was sort of the heyday of the Yakuza in Hawaii, which was kind of the mid 70s up until, you know, through the early or mid 80s. There was a lot of Yakuza activity in Hawaii. It used to be that Yakuza were here, well, first of all for fun and relaxation, but also it was kind of, they were supplying illegal services to Japanese tourists, prostitution, pornography, to a certain extent, drugs, and that sort of stuff. Same sort of stuff that was available, you know, to people in Japan, but were on vacation if they wanted those sort of things here. The Yakuza were here and were supplying them. There was also guns. Drugs were being shipped from Japan or from Asia to Hawaii, and guns were being shipped back the other way.
So what were the drugs at the time? Marijuana and heroin?
It was stimulants, meth, that kind of stuff. Shabu, you know, that.
Mm-hmm.
And that sort of stuff. But
this was full on Yakuza in terms of what they look like.
Oh,
and,
yeah.
And, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
For those. Those people who weren't here. I mean, now I think most people, if they watch Hawaii 5-0, that's the only exposure they have to the Yakuza,
and
it sounds like the Yakuza is still very active here. But their costuming, their presentation involved what, mutilation of the fingers and a few other things like that.
Yeah, I mean, I started, there's a guy here named Takeshi Takagi who was a member of a Tokyo-based Yakuza group called Sumiyoshi Rengo, who I got interested in, who was very, very busy here. He lived in a nice house on Wailaiki Ridge and was running a kind of a porno theater down in Chinatown. And he was a full-on member of the Yakuza gang who, you know, missing half of the little finger on one hand and the top section of his little finger on the other, heavily tattooed. And he was a busy man, and I ended up doing several big stories about him.
So what, in sum, if you had to sum up, what were their criminal activities here?
Well, it was smuggling drugs into Hawaii and smuggling guns out. That was the main activity. There was assorted prostitution and pornography enterprises aimed at Japanese tourists that were also going on. There is also, to a lesser extent, there was, you know, the Yakuza occupy a different kind of place in Japanese society. They sort of smooth things when people have difficulties. You know, they go to the Yakuza, and the Yakuza will sort of step in and sort of and try to help them. You know, with difficulties. And I think this is at the time of the bubble economy and a lot of Japanese investment here. And if they were having trouble buying a piece of property or financing a piece of property, the Yakuza were sort of assisting in those areas also.
That's the sort of argument, not argument, that's the sort of a way that Larry Mayhaw describes himself as a facilitator. Your chapter on Larry Mayhaw, which is late in the book, really talks about the fact that you can't understand why he's never been, he hasn't even been indicted, right?
No,
he's never been indicted, and you see him as a very important organized crime figure of some sorts, both before and after. And he described himself as basically a facilitator, that he has a lot of contacts, he helps people out.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's to this day, I don't know if he was an important organized crime figure. There certainly have been accusations to that effect, and a lot of people have believed it. You know, a lot of law enforcement officials have believed it. He's never been charged, let alone convicted of any crime.
And he's been pretty out front in defending himself against those accusations.
Absolutely,
but he has the network of people he has. This is not about whether he in fact is an organized crime or not, but the kind of influence network, important contacts in the police department, because he was a police officer. Mm-hmm. He ran a large company, a security company that mm-hmm. was politically connected, as they did work. And he knew powerful politicians. He was friends with powerful politicians.
He did. And he knew powerful criminals also. I mean, you know, he was kind of surrounded with people from the high and low of society, you know, and across the Pacific, actually.
So is there – do you see organized crime existing right now here in any way?
You know, Neil, I'm not really up on things, you know, but yes, I'm sure it's there. I don't see anything, you know, terribly overt, but you know, it's kind of human nature. You know, there's always going to be criminal activities, and there's always going to be people trying to organize them and get on top of them.
It's interesting that early on, when you look at why people have an appetite for this, at least the early stories, it seems to be pretty much around gambling. Mm-hmm. That there's this real interest in gambling. Gambling is illegal here, and so like many other places, illegal gambling develops and it gets pretty big. Most of the time, it's allowed to exist, and when it isn't allowed, when it comes under threat, it's as much because one gambler did violence or one head of the gambling operation did violence to the other as much as anything else.
Uh-huh.
And then on the other hand, you have these other kinds of pay to play, which is a very different, I mean, it may involve people's appetites. It certainly involves money, but the basis of it is rather different, right?
Oh, yeah, yeah. It's an entirely different, you know, enterprise.
And is that pretty much a part of the political culture, do you think, the pay-to-play?
I think so. I think it's a part of the political culture around the world, but certainly in Hawaii, yeah. Yeah.
And you have a situation in there where you suspect that there's something going on with the airport and procurements of making some decisions in advance who's going to get the jobs. Talk about that a bit.
Well, I got my hands on a piece of paper that listed I've forgotten how many, about half a dozen, or maybe
I think it was 11. Yeah.
Okay. Upcoming projects, engineering projects at the airport, and these were supposed to be awarded by competitive bidding, but someone had penciled in, you know, the ahead of time the company that was going to get
So the bids weren't in.
The bids were not in, but the ultimate winner of the jobs had already been penciled in the margin. And the person that gave this to me said, you watch these guys are going to the ones on the margin are going to get the job. And so in fact, I waited until I think one had already been awarded, and that didn't prove anything. So then I waited in the next one. The next one was in fact awarded to the company that had been penciled in, and I got the name of the individual who worked at the airport, an engineering official who had purportedly written these names down there, and I made arrangements to interview him, and he denied it, but it was sort of hard to deny, because the companies, had gotten the jobs, and they were all interrelated. There was an individual named Dennis Mitsunaga, who was an architect engineer in town, who was very friendly, a longtime friend and associate of Governor of Cayetano, who was the governor at the time, and there was all sorts of interconnections and suspicious activities in the awarding of these contracts. That was sort of the sum and substance of that.
So this was during the Cayetano administration.
Yes, it was. Yes.
There are other situations, but the one we're talking about is during the Cayetano administration.
Correct.
And your understanding was that he wanted to award these to local companies, and
right.
that he knew which local companies. Then you talked to him about this.
Right, yeah.
And he said?
He said... Well, I mean, what had happened was as I recall, one of the companies that was in line to get a contract didn't get the job, and so the governor had stepped in and said, I want this contract rebid and reawarded, and I want a local company to get this job. And so that's what they did. They then pulled back the results of that and then rebid it. And this particular company did get the job. And so I talked with the Attorney General Marjorie Bronster at the time and said, is this legal? And she said, no, you can't. This is wrong. You can't do it this way. So then I went to the governor and he said that there was nothing wicked about it. That it was just sort of accidental. But he would investigate. He'd take a look at this and he'd get to the bottom of it. Well, that never
Wait,
really happened.
He said it was accidental that he said to the airports people, you should pick this company.
He said he wanted a local company to get mm-hmm. the work, and he didn't direct, that a particular company get the work, or that, and didn't really realize that you can't single out, the origin of the company as a basis for giving it a contract.
He didn't realize it.
He didn't realize it. Well, he said he was going to get to the bottom of it and investigate how all this stuff happened, but as far as I know, that never happened, but...
Well, it may not have happened because he would have been investigating himself.
Could have been, yeah.
It might be. So in that situation, we're not saying there was a quid pro quo but the pay to play, as we understand it here, is that that company was getting something, and there was going to be likely to be some kind of contribution from that company.
Right. Yeah. That was the implication, clear implication of what was going on, yeah.
And that's sort of part of what political life is in Hawaii here.
Yeah, it is.
Yeah, that's that whole question of access and power, and now it's even easier, at least at a national level, to donate money because you have fewer limits. But it's always easy to plausibly deny that there was a quid pro quo involved because it's so hard to show the quid pro quo. Well, as long as we're on the subject of political officials being involved in some kind of corruption, let's talk about the Bishop Estate.
Okay.
Tell the story. For the readers who, if you were here, you couldn't help pay attention. If you're younger and you haven't read, say, Randy Roth's book or whatever, you may not know. So just walk us through it.
Well, the Bishop Estate was was always when things got slow for me, I would turn to the Bishop of State. It was just a remarkable institution. You know, it's a nonprofit that had somewhere in $6 billion in assets and dedicated to the education of children of Hawaiian ancestry. But the people that ran the Bishop of State were all extremely well connected politically. The five trustees who were appointed by the Hawaii Supreme Court, the five justices of the Supreme Court appointed the five trustees, and it was a lot of politics and
so that's by law. Just to clarify, the state Supreme Court by law appoints appoints the trustees of the Bishop of State. Okay.
I think that they may have set that aside
and
turned it over to other entities to make those trustee selections. But at the time that I was writing stories, and it was the trustees when I was doing stories were making, close to $1 million a year. And it was a very, very lucrative job.
Let's take a call from Jess from Pacific Heights, and then we'll get back to the story. Jess, go ahead.
Hey, guys. Aloha.
Aloha.
Interesting stuff, Mr. Dooley. And, haven't read your book. I may consider that for sure. But I'm wondering, is this just an anecdotal, entertaining read about previous and past administrations and illegal activities, so to speak, pay to play? Or is this something that steps up to the end and says, by the way, it's happening to you right now? I mean, I haven't heard the word rail used, and I'm sure you could put that in for every word you've used for airport. Does your book finally lead to something that says, hey, wake up, go out and vote, or anything like that, or is it purely anecdotal?
It's pretty much anecdotal. I think you can extrapolate from some of the chapters and some of the subjects covered that this is not stuff that's stopped and it's still going on, but it really is a story.
Is that to be extrapolated, or do you actually come out and say hello, everybody? You do realize that what's been going on in the past is certainly happening right now, if not even at a greater speed. Does it ever get to that point, or do you just kind of stay away from anything that might be too controversial?
Well, it was fairly controversial at the time, and it's not something. It's not a study of current events.
Jess, thanks for the call. I'm going to follow up with a question there, and that is, if you were going to look tomorrow, let's say you were still in the business, and we haven't talked about why you're not, but if you're still in the business and you were going to go out tomorrow and say, I'm going to look for a story that I think has potential for the kinds of things that I like to cover, where would you go?
The rail. It's kind of the elephant in the room. It's just there it is, and an awful lot of money, and if there's an opportunity for pay to play and quid pro quo, it's rail.
Well, and big capital projects, big capital improvement projects there's a lot of construction contracts. You can split them up. So that's where you would start. Where would you go first?
I'd have to look at the subcontracts. I think that's always a great place to start, and the award process for the who got the subcontracts and who didn't get the subcontracts, and try to talk to both sides there.
Let's go back to the Bishop of State. So there you explain how these trustees are on. This particular group was very heavily politically connected, and we're making a lot of money for a charitable institution that may or may not. At the time, they probably could make the money. After a while, the IRS got a little tough on them. But go on with what you were looking at then.
Well, I mean, I had started by looking at the various landed estates here, the Campbell estate and others, but I got particularly interested in the Bishop estate, simply because of the central role that it occupied and played in society in Hawaii. I mean, there was one of the early stories that I did had to do with the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court, who had personal and very lucrative business dealings with the Bishop of State. While at the same time, he was he was playing a direct role in selecting who was running the Bishop Estate. And it was that kind of mixture of public and private interests that got me particularly interested in the estate.
And he said, this was Chief Justice Lum at the time, he said, I have no conflict of interest. Now, what, he was a partner in a restaurant that was on Bishop Estate property, and then there were some other things?
Yeah, he had two commercial leases of Bishop Estate property worth somewhere, as I recall, in the vicinity of $1 million.
And he insisted that wasn't a conflict of interest. And in fact, according to rule, it wasn't because he got to decide. Right?
He decided.
He decided. That's how it worked at the time.
And he said that, listen, the Bishop Estate plays a pervasive role in island society. Everybody's got a connection one way or another to Bishop Estate. And in fact, I guess that was true. But his were particularly acute.
What was the most outrageous thing? The Bishop Estate is a long, complicated story. But what was the most outrageous thing you discovered when you were looking at that?
At Bishop Estate? I don't know. There was a lot of them. The investments that they had made. I mean, they were made them around the world. They had investment partners at the pinnacle of American business society. They had with their partners and I don't know. There was a trustee, Loki Lani Lindsay, who was a trustee of the estate. She was making $800,000-$900,000 a year in commissions from the estate, but she owned a small piece of property on the windward side, and she required the staff at the estate to handle the rezoning or the repair of her property, and it was just that kind of stuff.
I think the staff of the estate were some of the maintenance people that worked at Kamehameha Schools.
Yes, that was the kind of thing that you could afford to have hire somebody to do this for you, but she didn't.
It's interesting, right, that the small things seem to be the most outrageous. I mean, that thing didn't involve that much money,
right,
as opposed to some of the other things that involved millions and millions.
Well, the same thing happened, when I did stories about contract awards, at Aloha Stadium.
There's
the huge, huge contracts for the construction or the repair of the stadium or the Jumbotron, lots and lots of money. But the thing that people got most excited about was the contracts that were awarded for carpeting and drapes in the executive offices at Aloha Stadium. People got really, really worked up about those.
It pretty much cost him his job, right?
It did, yeah.
I'd like to finish by talking more about the investigative reporting career. And what was the splat file?
Well, that was stories that I had written that didn't meet the muster with the editor of the Advertiser at the time, whose name, was Mark Platt, It used to be that the word for if you wrote a story that didn't get published, it got spiked. Well, I changed that to splat, the splat file.
So. I get it. And what's the bigger implication of that?
Well, I don't know. There's always going to be friction, between a reporter and particularly an investigative reporter and editors. They have different jobs and serve different purposes. So when you have shrinkage in the news business that we've had these days, there's maybe one or two, reporters in the state that can call themselves investigative reporters now, it becomes very important, to sort of try to nurture this activity. And, I don't know how much nurturing is going on. And it's a shame.
I'm curious, who are those two that you would identify?
Well, it would be Rob Perez at the Star Advertiser and Keoki Kerr at Hawaii News Now, with, Rick Daysock kind of at Hawaii News Now also does some of that. But it's I can't think of any others.
What's the challenges of doing it on television?
Well, the challenges are getting video and getting people to talk to you on camera. I did it for 5 years and I was never terribly good at it, but it's it's a medium that kind of requires you to simplify or even oversimplify, you know, a story, but you have to fight against that because, you know, the story is, you know, it's not simple, you know, but you have to be able to convey it in simple terms and in short bursts. So it's a difficult thing to do.
Kiyoki gets some serialization, right? He gets to do consecutive days of a story.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
But that's pretty odd in journalism. What did you have, 3 minutes for your stories?
Yeah, 3 minutes at most, you know. But
so what's happening to investigative reporting, both here and nationally, and why is it happening?
Well, I tell you, I belong to an organization called Investigative Reporters and Editors, which is a really great organization, national group. And I went, they had the national convention in Philadelphia this year in June, and I went, and there was 1,700 people that attended this convention, which is more than they'd ever had before. I was very heartened by that. But so I think that the lesson that I drew from that is more that there are people out there, young reporters, who want to do this kind of work and are looking for ways and places to tell their stories. And I think that there are the hard part is finding the outlets and that can afford to pay for this kind of work and pay a living wage to the reporters that want to do it. I mean that's the hard part. There's more and more outlets on the web, but finding ones that you can trust and that will be willing to pay a living wage to a reporter is the tricky part.
Yeah, most people put stuff on the web for nothing.
Yeah.
So what's the situation in Hawaii? Is it like that, where you have young reporters eager to do that?
I think so. And the Civil Beat is certainly trying to do that sort of thing online. Hawaii News Now, and I should say that, you know, that Mark Platt, after he left the Advertiser, went to Hawaii News Now, and he's now the news director there, and is pursuing investigative work there, through Keoki and others. I'm not sanguine about the future. I'm afraid that I don't think that the Star Advertiser has done much of a job, you know, for they're the only game in town, you know, and I think they should be doing more, and I'm disappointed that they're not.
So your history ended, your later history ends as the last paper at Hawaii Reporter, which was an online one, mm-hmm. More or less went out of business.
Yeah.
They're still around, but in a different sort of format when Malia Zimmerman moved to the mainland. Mm-hmm. So would you go back to work tomorrow if you could?
I don't think I would. I'm kind of, you know, I sort of like this retirement gig, you know.
Hey, your book's selling thousands of copies. I mean, this is you'll be on Steve Colbert, you know, on Stephen Colbert's show very soon. So changing your attitude.
Like, get carried away here, but
well, I'll see what I can do. Go ahead. Yeah. So you're okay?
Yeah. 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 I'm good. I'm enjoying myself, and I may come back to doing some reporting or work on another book. But at this point, I'm just sort of flogging the product that I have out there now.
Anybody asking you to mentor them?
Not really. No, not yet. But
do you talk down at the university at all? I mean, you go
once
down
in a while, lectures. Yeah. And I just last week I went and talked to classes at Honolulu Community College, and you know, and actually a good group of kids.
Good. So, I think that does it. About it. We've been talking to Jim Dooley, the investigative reporter and the author of Sunny Skies, Shady Characters. Jim, thanks a lot for doing the show, and good luck with the book. It's an excellent read.
Thanks,
I've read it twice.
Thanks, Neil. I appreciate it. Thanks for having me on.
Sure. Aloha, everybody.